your hands be tainted with the ash, and it gets on the clean, damp white sheets, sticks to them. Zed silently considered the problem for a time.
Addie, he whispered, we must somehow clean our hands, wash the taint away.
You have a talent for stating the obvious, old man.
Zed checked his tongue and took a different tack.
Addie, I hired us a coach to take us to Nicobarisi, but you're getting weaker, and I'm not going to be long behind. I don't know if we can wait. If there's another way, maybe someone else closer who can help us, I must know.
There be no other way. There be no one else.
Well, what about this woman who had the three daughters? Perhaps she studied somewhere closer to learn some of these things. Maybe we could go there instead.
It not be a help.
Why not?
Addie considered him a moment, and at last yielded.
She studied with the Sisters of the Light.
Zed shot to his feet.
What?
He paced back and forth between the bed and the fireplace.
Bags, and double bags, I knew it, I knew it!
Zed, she studied with them to learn. Then she returned home. She not be a sister. The sisters not be so unreasonable as you think.
He halted to peer at her with one eye.
And how would you know that?
Addie gave a resigned sigh.
The round scrinbone, the one that be given to me just before the woman died, the one I told you be important, the one we lost back at my house, the gifted woman who gave it to me, be a sister of the light.
And what was she doing in the new world?
Zed asked in a level tone.
She not be in the new world. I be in the old world at the time.
Zed put both fists on his hips as he leaned toward her.
You crossed the Valley of the Lost? You went into the old world? You're just filled right up full with little secrets.
Addie shrugged with one shoulder.
I told you I searched out women with a gift, to learn from them what I could, some of them be in the old world. I used my one passing through the valley and back to learn what I could of what I needed to know.
Addie snugged the blanket tighter around her shoulders.
The sisters, some of them taught me the little bits they knew. Important little bits. The sisters view it as their province to know about the Keeper, the Nameless One, as they call him, in order to keep souls from his grasp. I did not stay at their palace long. They would not let me stay unless I wished to be one of them. But for a time they let me study with them, studying things in their vaults. There be sisters in the palace I would not trust to cook me breakfast. But there be some who were great help.
Muttering, Zed started pacing again.
The Sisters of the Light are misguided zealots. They make the blood of the fold look to be reasonable men.
He came to a halt.
And when you were there, did you see any of their boys? Did you see if they even had any with a gift?
I had my own learning to attend to. I not be there to argue theology with the sisters. That not be a wise thing to do. They did not let me have anything to do with their charges, if indeed they had any. I be sure that if they had any boys, they be boys from their side. They know better than to risk violation of that truce. They strongly fear what wizards on this side would do if they did. They let me learn what I could from them, and let me study in the vaults. But they never let me see any boys, nor would they tell me if they had any.
Well, of course they don't have any, he snapped. There are almost never any born with a gift anymore. Too many wizards have been killed in the wars. We are a dying breed. And as first wizard, I would never turn down the teaching of one with the gift, as happened thousands of years ago. Nor would any wizard I taught. And the sisters know that. They know the rules. They may not take a gifted one unless every wizard declines to teach him. To go against the rules just once would mean a death sentence to any sister that ever again crossed that valley.
They know that, Zed. They take that threat seriously.
Well, they ought to know it. I met up with one of them once, when I was young, and I sent my warning to the prelate.
He flexed his fists as he stared off.
They are barbaric in their methods. They are children teaching surgery. If I knew how to get past those accursed towers, I'd go down there and lay waste to the palace of the prophets.
Zed, in that time past, many with the gift died because there be none who would teach them to control it. Those with the power were possessive of it, and did not want to train another who one day might be a threat to their power. They abandoned those born with a gift, left them to die by the power of the thing they be born with, but didn't know how to control. The sisters didn't want to let those abandoned boys die. They'd just be doing what they think best to help people.
He cast her a withering glare.
The sisters of the light do only what is best for the sisters of the light.
Maybe so. But they are sworn to follow the rules, the truce, just as you do, by letting them be when they come here.
He stared off, shaking his head.
To let those with the gift die simply for their own selfish gain. If they had lived up to their responsibilities as wizards, the Sisters of the Light would never have come to be. Never been needed.
With his boot, he brushed a dead ember on the flagstone hearth back into the fireplace.
They would never think of allowing a wizard to teach a young sorceress to use her gift, yet they presume to teach a young wizard how to use his.
Zed, I believe as you, but listen to me. Dead and buried causes and wars not be our concern. The veil be torn. The stone of tears be in the world of the living. Those be our concerns. I went to those women to learn. Magic I learned there, and have taught you, though insufficient to stop the taint, has been able to slow it. We must purge the taint before it claims us.
His mood cooled under the scrutiny of her white eyes.
Of course you are right, Addie. We have pressing problems to deal with.
She favored him with one of her little smiles.
I be glad you be wise enough to listen to wisdom.
He rubbed the ache in the back of his neck, squeezing the tight muscles.
Do you really think this woman with the three daughters would have known about this taint? It's a long way to go on a hunch and a hope.
She studied with the Sisters of the Light many years. They liked her and wanted her to stay to be a sister. But she did not believe as they, and so finally went home. I don't know the extent of her knowledge, but if the sisters know anything about the taint and taught her, she would have taught her daughters. As much as I don't like the idea, they be in Nicobarisi.
When Zed saw Addie wrapping the blanket up around her shoulders, he closed the window. Kneeling at the hearth, he placed a handful of kindling on the grate and stacked on wood from the bucket to the side. He was about to use magic to start the fire, but thought better of it, and instead lit a stick in the lamp. He squatted, touching the flame to the curls of the kindling.
Zed, my friend, Addie said in a quiet, gentle voice, I not be a sister of the light. I know that be what you are wondering. I not be one of them.
That was exactly what Zed had been wondering.
And if you were, he asked without turning, would you tell me?
She was silent. He looked over his shoulder to see her smiling at him.
The Sisters of the Light value honesty above almost anything else, but to them, lying in the service of the Creator be a virtue.
The fire took a good start. Zed stood before her, looking down without returning her smile.
That is no comfort to me.
She took hold of his hand, patting it with her other.
Zed, I will tell you the truth. I be in debt to some of them for the things they did for me. But I give you an oath on the soul of my dead pal. I not be a sister of the light. I would never let them have one of the gifted from our side, as long as I knew there'd be a wizard to teach him. I would never allow a boy to be taken and subjected to their ways, had I a say.
Zed smoothed the fringe of a carpet with his foot.
I know you're not one of them, dear lady. It's just that I hate the thought of those women doing those things to one with a gift, when I can show them the joy of their talent. It's a gift. They treat it like a curse.
With a thumb, she rubbed the back of his hand.
I see you have yourself a dashing new cane.
Zed grunted.
I hate to think what Master Hillman is scheming to charge me for it.
And did you find us transportation?
Zed nodded.
A man named Ahern. We better try to get a bit of sleep. He's going to be here with a coach 3 hours before dawn.
He gave her a grim look.
Addie, until we get to Nicobarisi and can rid ourselves of this taint, I think we'd better consider the consequences very carefully before using magic.
Are we safe here?
A soft hand extended from the fog of dim light, brushing her cheek, comforting her.
You are safe here, Rachel. Both of you are safe. Now and always, you are safe.
Rachel smiled. She did feel safe. Safer than she ever felt before. Not just safe like she felt when she was with Chase, but safe like she had felt in her mother's arms. She hadn't been able to remember her mother before, but she remembered now. Remembered the encircling arms holding her to a breast. The terrible fright she had shared with Chase while they raced to catch Richard was melting away. The bone-tired worry of whether or not they would catch him in time was melting away. The terror of the people who had tried to stop them. The fights Chase had had, the horror of the blood she had seen, all the blood she had seen. It was all melting away. As she stood before the sparkling pool, the hands reached to her again, reached to her from the gentle smiles of reassurance. The hands helped her undo the buttons of her dirty, sweaty dress and pull it off. She flinched when her dress pulled against the bruise on her shoulder, the bruise she got when a man chasing them had knocked her down. The smiles turned to sad looks of concern for her pain. The soft, gentle voices cooed comfort to her. The glowing hands caressed the shoulder, and when they lifted, the bruise was gone, the hurt was gone.
All better?
Rachel nodded.
Yes, it's all better, thank you.
The hands pulled off her shoes and stockings. She sat on a warm rock and dangled her bare feet in the soothing water. It would be so wonderful to bathe and be rid of the dirt and sweat. The hands reached for the stone hanging on the necklace around her neck. The hands drew back as if afraid.
We cannot remove this thing. You must do it without our help.
Through the soothing warmth and security of the beautiful land around her, through the comfort of the peace she had found, through her desire to do as the gentle murmurs had asked, a voice rose up in her mind. It was Zed's voice, telling her that she must not give the stone to anyone for any reason, telling her how important it was for her to guard it always. She looked up from the circles of ripples her feet made in the water to the gentle faces.
I don't want to take it off. Can't I leave it on?
The smiles returned and widened.
Of course you can, Rachel, if that is what you wish, if that is what would make you happy.
I want it to stay on. That would make me happy.
Then it will stay on, now and forever, if you wish.
She smiled a smile of peace and security as she slipped into the soothing water. It felt so good. She floated and drifted. She felt all her troubles sloughing away with the dirt. One moment it seemed she couldn't feel any more safe or happy, and then the next moment she did, and then the next yet more. She drew her arms through the healing, cleansing golden water, swimming toward the other side of the pool where she remembered leaving Chase. She found him almost up to his neck in the water. His head tilted back, resting on a soft mat of grass at the bank. His eyes were closed, and he had a wonderful smile on his face.
Father?
Yes, daughter, he whispered without opening his eyes. She swam up beside him. He lifted an arm, and she slipped under it. It felt so good to have his arm around her shoulders, comforting her.
Father, do we ever have to leave this place?
No. They say we can stay forever.
She nuzzled against him.
I'm so glad.
She slept, really slept, like she couldn't remember ever sleeping before, so safe and sheltered, though she didn't know how long. When she dressed, her clothes were clean and seemed to sparkle like new. Chase's clothes, too, were bright and shiny. She held hands and danced in circles with other children, glowing children, whose voices and laughter echoed. It made her laugh, too, laugh with happiness like none she had ever felt before. When she was hungry, she and Chase lay in the grass, the warm fog, and glowing, smiling faces around them, and ate things that were sweet and delicious. When she was tired, she slept, never having to worry about where she slept, because she was safe, safe at last. And when she wanted to play, the other children came to play with her. They loved her. Everyone loved her. She loved everyone. Sometimes she walked alone. Filmy shafts of sunlight streamed through the trees. Glowing meadows were filled with wildflowers, bowing in the gentle breeze, winking with bright specks of color. Sometimes she walked with Chase, holding his hand. She was so happy that he was contented now, too. He never had to fight anyone anymore. He was safe, too. He said he was at peace. He sometimes took her for walks and showed her the woods where he said he grew up, where he said he had played when he was as little as she. She smiled with delight at the look of happiness in his eyes. She loved him and was fulfilled knowing he, like she, had found peace at last. She looked up, and a small smile touched her thin lips. She hadn't heard a sound, and she needn't turn to look in the near darkness. She knew he was there, on the other side of the door. She knew how long he had been there. Her legs still crossed, she rose smoothly on a cushion of air hovering above the straw-covered floor. The boy's limp arms swung as they dangled, like weighted fishing line. Lacking any life or rigidity, his back bent backward, draping over her arm. In her other hand was clutched the statue. She unfolded her legs and stretched her slippered feet to the floor, settling her weight on them. As the boy slid from her arm, the dead weight of his head thunked against the floor. His arms and legs flopped askew to one side. His clothes were filthy. Disgusted, she wiped her hands on her skirts. "Why don't you come in, Jedediah?" Her voice echoed from the cold stone. "I know you're there. Don't try to pretend you're not." The heavy door squeaked slowly open, and the shadowed figure strolled into the light of a single candle burning on a rickety nearby table that was the lower room's only accoutrement. He stood relaxed, silently watching, as the orange glow faded from her eyes, and they returned to the pale, pale blue shot through with violet flecks. His gaze went to the statue in her hand. "The owner sent me to find that. She wants it back." The thin smile grew. "Does she now?" she shrugged. "Well, I'm through with it." She held it out to him. "For now." Jedediah's face was a calm mask as he took the statue. "She doesn't like it when you borrow her things." She ran a finger down his cheek. "She is not the one I serve. I don't really care what she likes and what she doesn't." "You would be wise to care a little more." Her smile brightened. "Really? I could give her the same advice." She twisted, holding an arm out to the body on the floor. He had the gift. Slowly, her hard eyes came back to his, the smile gone, as if one had never touched her features in all her life. Her voice came in a venomous hiss. "I have it now." The slightest frown of puzzlement touched his cool expression. "Think we must have the ceremony, Jedediah? The ritual in the Hagen Woods?" She slowly shook her head. "Not anymore. That is only the first time, because we are female, and female Han cannot absorb the male." Her voice lowered to a derisive whisper. "Not any longer. Now that I have the gift of a male, I can accept others without the ritual." Her face glided to within inches of his. "So can you, Jedediah," she breathed. "With the Quillian, so can you. I could teach you. It's so easy. I simply showed him the joining rite to try to show him his Han." Her cheek brushed his as she whispered into his ear. "But he didn't know how to control his gift. I created the vacuum in the Quillian." She drew back to appraise his eyes. "It sucked the life right out of him, sucked the gift right out of him. It's mine now." He studied her eyes a time before glancing down at the body. "I don't recall seeing him before." She continued to whisper to him from only inches away, "Don't play games with me, Jedediah. What you really mean is, where did I find him and why haven't the sisters, if he has the gift?" He shrugged nonchalantly. "If he has the gift, why isn't he collared?" She cocked her head to the side. "Because he is so young. His Han is too weak to be detected by the other sisters." She tilted her head to the other side. "But not by me." She touched her nose to his. "He was right here in the city, right under their noses. Probably the offspring of a dalliance by one of you naughty boys." "Very efficient. Saves having to bother with reports. Avoids awkward questions." She glanced down at the body.
Be a good boy and dispose of him for me. I found him living in squalor, down near the river. Dump him back there. No one will think anything of it.
He lifted an eyebrow. You wish me to clean up after you? She ran a finger down his neck and across his throat, across his Radahan.
You make a serious mistake, Jedediah, if you think of me as a mere sister. I have the male gift now, same as you, and I know how to use it. You wouldn't believe how much that power increases when you add the Han of another.
It would appear that you are becoming a sister to be reckoned with. A wise person would take care with you.
She patted his cheek. Smart boy, Jedediah.
She gave him a little frown as she slipped her hands to his waist.
You know, Jedediah, you may think of yourself as powerful in the gift, but I think you should worry about that. You have never had one to challenge your abilities before, your rightful place among the wizards here. But a new one comes. He will be here soon, and you have never seen one like this before. I think you may no longer be the pride of the palace.
His countenance showed no reaction, but his face slowly heated to red. He lifted the statue. Well, you did say you would like to teach me. She waggled a finger in front of his face.
He is mine.
You may have another.
Any gift will swell your power, but this one is mine.
He waggled the statue in front of her face. She might have something to say about that. She has plans of her own, plans for him. She smiled with one side of her mouth.
I know, and you are going to keep me informed of her plans.
He lifted an eyebrow. You have plans for me? The smile grew to both sides of her mouth.
Very special plans.
Her hands roamed lower down the sides of his hips, feeling the firmness of his young muscles under his robes.
You're good with your hands, good at making things in metal. I have something I want you to make for me, something invested with magic. I hear that's one of your talents with the gift.
You wish a trinket? An amulet, perhaps, in silver or gold?
No, no, dear boy. You're going to make it from steel. You're to gather the steel of 100 sword points. Very special sword points. Sword points from the armory. Old ones. Ones that have been used. Ones that have pierced flesh in combat.
He arched an eyebrow. And what is it you wish made? She slid a hand up the inside of his thigh.
Talk about it later.
She smiled at how quickly he responded to her touch.
You must be lonely since Margaret ran away. So lonely. I think you need a friend who understands you. Did you know, Jedediah, that with the male Han comes a unique understanding of the male? I now understand in a new light what it is that men appreciate. I think we're going to be very special friends. As a special friend, you get the reward before performing the task.
She trickled a thread of magic into him, focusing it where it would do the most good. Her smile widened as his head rolled back. His eyes closed, and he let out a throaty groan, and then gasped. Panting, he clutched his hands to her bottom, drawing her to him, and crushed his open mouth to hers. She kicked the body out of her way as she let him force her to the straw-covered floor. Chapter 36. The Wolverine grew larger in his vision. The arrow waited for the flat, dark head to lift. A low growl came from behind his left shoulder.
Quiet!
Richard hissed. The gar fell silent. The Wolverine's head rose. With a zip, the arrow was away. Wings aquiver, the little gar bounced on the balls of its feet, its attention riveted to the flight of the arrow.
Wait!
He whispered. The gar froze. With a solid thunk, the arrow found its target. The gar squealed in glee. Wings spreading and flapping, it bounced higher and turned to him. Richard leaned close and pointed a finger at the gar's wrinkly nose. The gar watched him attentively. All right, but you bring me back my arrow. Head bobbing in quick agreement, the gar bounded into the air. Richard watched by the dim early dawn light as it swooped down on the dead quarry, pouncing as if it were about to escape. Fur flew as claws ripped. The dark silhouette lowered, its wings folding against its back as it hunched over the prey, growling and pulling its meal apart. Richard turned from the sight and watched instead the streaks of cloud change color against the brightening sky. Sister Verna would be awake soon. He still stood his watch, despite her insistence that it wasn't necessary. She finally relented, but he knew she was angry because he wouldn't back down. That made her angry. What didn't? She was more angry than usual since coming through the valley the day before. She was silently livid. Richard glanced toward the little guard to see it was still eating. How it had managed to follow him through the Valley of the Lost, he couldn't imagine. He had thought it was a mistake to keep feeding it before they reached the valley, but he felt responsible for it. Every night when he had taken his watch, it had come to him, and he had hunted food for it. He had thought he had seen the last of it when they crossed over into the old world, but somehow it had followed. The little gar was passionately devoted to him when he was on watch. It ate with him, played with him, and slept at his feet, if not on them. When his watch was over, it hardly made a fuss about him leaving. Richard never once saw the gar at any other time. It seemed to instinctively know to stay away from the sister, to avoid letting her see it. Richard was reasonably certain she would try to kill it. Maybe the gar knew that. He was continually surprised by the intelligence of the furry little beast. It learned faster than any animal he had ever seen. Kaelin had told him that the short-tailed gars were smart. Now he knew how right she was. He had only to show it something once or twice to make it understand. It was learning to understand his words and tried to imitate them, although it didn't seem to have the capacity for speech. Some of its sounds came strangely close. Richard didn't know what to do about the gar. He thought perhaps it should strike out on its own, learn to hunt and survive, but it wouldn't leave. It followed, out of sight, wherever they went, even through danger. Perhaps it was too young to get by on its own. Maybe it saw Richard as its only way to survive. Maybe it saw him as a surrogate mother. In truth, Richard didn't really want it to leave. It had become a friend as they had traveled through the wilds. It gave him unconditional love, never criticized him, and never argued with him. It felt good to have a friend. How could he deny the same thing to the gar? The flap of wings brought him out of his thoughts. The gar thumped to the ground before him. It had gained a lot of weight since Richard had first found it. He would have sworn it had grown nearly half a foot, too. The sinew under the pink skin of the chest and belly had become taut, and its arms were no longer all hide and bone as they had been, but were thickening with muscle. He was afraid to think of how big it would eventually get. He hoped it would be on its own by then. Hunting enough food to feed a full-grown short-tailed gar would be a full-time occupation. After wiping the shaft on its fur-covered thigh to clean off the blood, the gar flashed Richard its hideous blood-stained grin and held out the arrow. Richard pointed over his shoulder. "I don't want it. Put it back where it belongs." The gar reached over Richard's shoulder and slid the arrow back into the quiver that leaned against a stump. It contorted its features, seemingly to question if he had done it correctly. Richard smiled as he patted its full belly. "Good boy. You did it right." The gar flopped happily on the ground at his feet, contenting itself with licking blood from its claws and coarse fur. When it finished, it laid its long arms over Richard's lap and rested its head on them. "You need a name." The gar looked up, cocking its head to the side. Its tufted ears turned toward him. "Name." He tapped his chest. "My name is Richard." The gar reached out and tapped Richard's chest in imitation. "Richard, Richard." It cocked its head to the other side. It growled through sharp fangs, its ears twitching. Richard nodded. "Richard." It tapped Richard's chest again. It said in its throaty growl, this time showing less teeth. "Richard." "Richard." Richard laughed. "That's close. Now, what are we going to call you?" Richard thought about it, trying to think of something appropriate. The gar sat, its brow bunched into deep furrows, watching him intently. After a moment, it took Richard's hand and tapped it against his chest.
"Richard,"
it said. It pulled Richard's hand to its own chest, tapping it against the fur.
"Gretch."
"Gretch?" Richard sat up straighter in surprise. Your name is Gratch? He tapped the gar again. Gratch? The gar nodded and grinned as it tapped its own chest.
Gratch! Gratch!
Richard was a little taken aback. It had never occurred to him that the gar might have a name.
Gratch it is, then.
He tapped his own chest again. Richard! He smiled and patted the gar's shoulder. Gratch! The gar spread its wings and thumped its chest with open claws.
Gratch!
Richard laughed and the gar leapt on him, letting out its throaty giggle as it wrestled him to the ground. Gratch's love of wrestling was second only to its love of food. The two of them tumbled across the ground, laughing and struggling to gently get the best of each other. Richard was gentler about it than Gratch. The gar would put its mouth around Richard's arm, though, thankfully, at least it never bit. Its needle-sharp fangs were long enough to easily go all the way through his arm, and he had seen the gar splinter bone with those teeth. Richard brought the wrestling match to an end by sitting up on a stump. Gratch sat straddling him, arms, legs, and wings wrapped around him. It nuzzled against Richard's shoulder. Gratch knew that at dawn, Richard left. Richard spied a rabbit in the underbrush some distance off and thought that perhaps Sister Verna would appreciate some meat for breakfast. Gratch, I need a rabbit. Gratch climbed off his lap as Richard took up his bow. After the arrow was off, he told the guard to bring him the rabbit, but not to eat it. Gratch had learned to retrieve and was happy to do it. He always got what was left of the skinning and gutting. After Richard was done and had bid Gratch goodbye, he hiked back to the camp. His mind wandered back to the vision of Kaelin he had had in the tower and the things she had told him. The sight of her being beheaded haunted him. He recalled her words, "Speak if you must these words, but not of this vision. Of all there were, but a single one born of the magic to bring forth truth will remain alive when the shadow's threat is lifted. Therefore comes the greater darkness of the dead. For there to be a chance at life's bond, this one in white must be offered to her people to bring their joy and good cheer." He knew who the "this one in white" was. He knew what "bring their joy and good cheer" meant. He thought, too, about the prophecy that Sister Verna had told him of, the one that said, "He is the bringer of death, and he shall so name himself." She claimed the prophecy said that the holder of the sword is able to call the dead forth, call the past into the present. He wondered and worried what that could mean. At the camp, he found Sister Verna squatted at the fire, cooking bannock. The aroma made his stomach grumble. The sparsely wooded country was coming to life with sounds of animals and bugs heralding the dawn. Clusters of small dark birds sang from the tall, thinly foliated trees, and gray squirrels chased each other up and down their branches. Richard hung the skewer with the rabbit over the fire as Sister Verna continued to mind the bannock. "I brought you some breakfast. I thought you might like some meat." She gave only a grunt of acknowledgement. "You still angry with me for saving your life yesterday?" She carefully laid another small stick on the fire. "I am not angry with you for saving my life, Richard. I thought you said your creator hated lies. Do you think he believes you? I don't." Her face turned so red Richard thought her curly hair might catch fire. "You will not speak blasphemy. And lying is not? You do not understand, Richard, why I'm angry." Richard sat on the ground and, grasping his ankles, folded his legs in. "Maybe I do. You're supposed to be my protector, not the other way around. Maybe you feel that you have failed, but I don't feel that you failed. We both just did what we had to survive." "Did what we must?" Fine wrinkles radiated around her eyes as they narrowed. "As I recall from the book, when Bonnie Geraldine and Jessup led the people across the Poison River, some of those people died." Richard smiled to himself. "So you really did read it?" "I told you I did. That was foolhardy. We could have been killed taking that risk." "We didn't have any choice." "You always have a choice, Richard. That is what I'm trying to teach you." She sat back on her heels. "The wizards who created that place thought they had no choice, but they made things worse. You were using your Han back there, and you were doing it without understanding the consequences. What choice did we have?" Hands on her knees, she leaned forward.
We always have a choice, Richard. You were lucky this time that your use of magic didn't get you killed.
What are you talking about? Sister Verna drew a saddlebag close and started rummaging through it, finally pulling out a green cloth bag.
You got some blood from that beast on your arm. Did any of the bugs bite you?
On my legs.
Show me.
Richard pulled up his pant legs and showed her the swollen red bites. She shook her head and, whispering to herself, pulled first one and then a second bottle from the bag. With a stick found on the ground nearby, she dipped a white paste from one bottle and wiped it onto the flat of a knife blade. She threw the stick in the fire. Taking another stick, she dipped a dark paste from the other bottle and mixed it with the light on the flat side of the blade, then spread it along the edge. She threw the second stick with some of the mixed paste on it into the fire. Richard flinched when it exploded in a white-hot ball of fire that lifted skyward, dissipating it as it rose, turning to a boiling cloud of black smoke. She held up the knife to reveal a gray paste spread on the blade. Light and dark. Earth and sky. Magic to heal what would otherwise kill you by tonight. You have a way of getting yourself out onto thin limbs, Richard. Each step you take only makes your predicament worse. Now come over here, closer. Richard dug his heels in and scooted around the fire. Were you trying to decide whether or not you were going to help me?
Of course not. This is made from powerful magic, constructed magic, to smother the venom injected into you by the conjured creatures. Too soon and the cure would kill you. Too late, the bites would kill you. It must be the right kind of magic at the right time. I was simply waiting for the proper time.
Richard wanted to argue with her, but instead said, "Thank you for helping me." She frowned at him before leaning over his bites.
"Sister, how was I making things worse?" "You were being reckless. Using magic is dangerous not only to others, but to the one who calls it forth as well."
Richard winced as she drew the edge across one of the bites, first one way, then the other, cutting an X on it. The sting made his eyes water.
"How can it be dangerous to me?"
She concentrated as she leaned over his leg, whispering an incantation while stroking the knife across his swollen flesh. He tried not to jump when she cut the next bite. She was only making light cuts, but they stung fiercely.
"It is like starting a fire in the center of a tinder dry wood. You find yourself in the center of the fire, in the center of what you have started. What you did was foolish and dangerous."
"Sister Verna, I was trying to stay alive." She jabbed a finger at one of the painful bites.
"And look what happened. If I don't heal you, you'll die."
She finished with his legs and turned her attention to his arm. "When we were being attacked by those beasts, you thought to save us, but everything you did only increased the danger." When she finished, she held a knife blade over the fire. A thin stream of white flame roared up from the steel, consuming the remaining paste. She held the blade to the fire until the paste and the white flame were gone.
"If I hadn't acted, sister, we would be dead."
She shook the hot blade at him.
"I did not say you were wrong to act. I said you acted in the wrong way. You used the wrong kind of magic."
"I used the only thing I had, the sword." She pitched the knife. With a thunk, it stuck solidly in a piece of firewood.
"Acting without knowing the consequences of the magic you call forth is perilous behavior."
"Well, nothing you were doing was helping." Sister Verna rocked back on her heels, stared at him for a moment, and then turned to busy herself with replacing the bottles in the green bag.
"I'm sorry, sister. I didn't really mean that. It didn't come out the way I intended. I only meant that you weren't able to sense the way, and I knew if we stayed, we would be killed."
The bottles clinked together as she moved them around in the bag. She seemed to be having difficulty getting them packed the way she wanted.
"Richard, you think that controlling the gift using magic is what you are to learn with us. That is the easy part. Knowing what kind of magic to use, how much to use, when to use it, and the consequences of using it, that is the hard part. That is the meaning of everything. How much, when, and what if. Just like the magic I have put on your bites."
She fixed him with a deadly serious expression.
"Without that knowledge, you are a blind man swinging an axe in a crowd of children.
You have no idea of the danger you invoke when you use magic. We try to give you sight and some sense before you swing that axe.
Richard picked at a clump of grass at his feet. I never thought about it that way.
Perhaps, if anything, I should be angry with myself for being foolish. I didn't think there was anything powerful enough to tempt me into a trap. I was wrong. Thank you, Richard, for saving me.
He wrapped a long stalk of grass around his finger. I was so relieved to find you. I thought you were dead. I'm glad you're not. She had pulled all the little bottles out of the bag and set them on the ground.
I could have been lost in that spell for all time. I should have been.
What do you mean?
There seemed to him to be more bottles than would fit into the bag, but then
he had seen them all come out.
We have tried to rescue sisters before. We have seen some, and their charges, lost in those enchantment spells. I saw one the first time I went through. We have never been able to get them out. Sisters have died trying.
She started replacing the bottles.
You used magic.
I used the sword. The sword has magic, you know.
No, you didn't use the sword's magic. You used your han, even though you didn't realize it. Using your han through desire without wisdom is the most dangerous thing you can do.
Sister, I think it was just the sword's magic.
When you call to me, I heard you. We have tried to call to others, and they have never heard us, not once.
You just didn't know how. You couldn't hear me either until I stepped through some sort of sparkling wall around you. Then you could hear me. You just have to step through that wall first.
She pushed bottles to each side to make more room as she spoke softly. We know that, Richard. We have tried every sort of magic and have never been able to pass through or break the wall of one of these spells, or been able to get the attention of one captured by it. No one has ever been brought out of an enchantment spell before.
She replaced the last bottle and finally turned to face him.
Thank you, Richard.
He shrugged as he pulled the grass off his finger. Well, it was the least I could do to make up for what I did.
For what you did?
Richard occupied himself with carefully rolling his pants back down. Well, before I saved you, I kind of killed you. She leaned closer.
You did what?
You were hurting me with your magic, with the collar.
I'm sorry, Richard. I was in the spell and didn't realize what I was doing. I didn't intend to hurt you.
He shook his head. Not then, before, in the White Tower. She leaned even closer and gritted her teeth.
You went into a tower? Are you mad? I told you what those towers are. How could you be so...
Sister, I had no choice.
We have already discussed choice. I told you how dangerous those towers are. I told you to stay away from them.
Look, there was lightning all around. It was trying to strike me. I didn't know what else to do. So I dove through an archway into the tower for protection.
Can't you follow the simplest instructions? Must you always act a child?
Richard looked up from under his eyebrows. Those were your exact words. You came into the tower. I was sure it was you. You were angry with me, much as you are now, and you used those exact words. He gritted his teeth as he put a finger to the collar at his neck. You used this. You used it to throw me against the wall and pin me there with it. Can this collar do that, sister? She sat much quieter.
Yes. We don't have the power of a wizard, the male Han. The collar amplifies our power, so we may be stronger than the one wearing it, so we can teach them.
His voice was deep with anger. Then you used it to give me pain, like the pain you did for real when you were in the spell. Only it was stronger, and went on and on. Can the collar do that too, sister?
She pulled a clump of grass to her side and began cleaning her hands with it, avoiding his glare. Yes, but that was a vision, Richard. I wasn't really doing it.
I told you to stop hurting me, or I would put a stop to it. You wouldn't stop, so I called the sword's magic and broke the bond of the power holding me. You were furious. You said that I had made my last mistake. You said you were going to kill me for fighting you. You were going to kill me, sister.
I'm sorry, Richard, she whispered as she looked up, that you had to suffer that.
Her voice regained some of its strength.
So what did you do to me, to the vision of me?
He leaned over and touched the edge of his first finger to the side of her shoulder. I cut you in half with the sword, right here. Her hands stopped. She was stone still. Some of the color had left her face. Finally, she regained her composure. Richard picked at the clump of grass by his foot again. I really didn't want to do it, but I was positive you were going to kill me. She tossed the grass aside. I'm sure you were, Richard, but that was only a vision. If it were real, it wouldn't have turned out that way. You would not have been able to do what you did. Who are you trying to convince, sister, me or yourself? She met his glare. The things you saw were not as they are in the real world. They were simply illusions. Richard let it drop. He turned the stick with the rabbit to cook the other side and slid the iron plate with the bannock to the side of the fire to let it cool. Anyway, when I saw you again, I didn't know if you were a vision or real, but I truly hoped you were alive. I didn't want to kill you. He looked up and smiled. Besides, I promised you that you would get through the Valley of the Lost. She nodded. Yes, you did. More desire than wisdom, indeed. Sister, I was only doing what I could think of to survive, to help you survive, too. She sighed and shook her head. Richard, I know you're trying to do your best, but you must understand that what you think is best is not necessarily right. You're calling your Han without knowing what you're doing or even realizing you're doing it. In so doing, you tempt danger you can't fathom. How was I using my Han? Wizards make promises that their Han strives to keep. You promised me you would help me through the valley, save me. But in so doing, you have invoked prophecy. Richard frowned. I've given no prophecy. Not only given it, but used your Han without realizing it. Used prophecy without knowing its form, to do something in the past to aid you in the future. What are you talking about? You destroyed the horse's bits. I told you at the time why I did that. They're cruel. She shook her head. That's what I'm talking about. You think you did it for one reason, but it served another purpose. Your conscious mind is simply seeking to rationalize what your Han is doing. When we were running from the valley, I didn't believe in what you were doing, and I tried to turn my horse, because he didn't have a bit. I was unable to. So what? She leaned closer. Destroying the bits in the past satisfied a need of a promise in the future. That was using prophecy. You're swinging the axe blindly. Richard gave her a skeptical expression. That's a stretch, sister, even for you. I know how the gift works, Richard. Richard thought about it and finally decided he didn't believe her, but decided, too, that he didn't want to argue with her about it. There were other things he wanted to know. Is your little book full? I haven't seen you writing in it. I sent a message yesterday that we have come through the valley. I have nothing else to write, that's all. The book is magic. With magic, we erase old messages. I erased all but 2 pages. But with what I added yesterday, there are now 3 pages full. Richard tore off a corner of the hot bannock. Who is the prelate? She charges the Sisters of the Light. She is... Her eyes narrowed. I've never mentioned her. How do you know of her? Richard licked the crumbs from his fingers. I read it in your book. Her hand flew to her belt, groping for the book. It was there, where it always was. You've read my private writing? You have no right. I will... You were dead at the time. Her mouth snapped shut, and he went on. When I killed you, or the illusion of you, the book fell on the ground. I read it. The tension left her muscles. Oh, well, that's simply part of the illusion. I told you, it's not as things are in life. Richard tore off another corner of bannock. There were only 2 pages with writing, just as the real book. Not until after we were through the valley did you add the 3rd. Back then, there were only 2. She watched him eating the bannock. Illusion, Richard. He looked up. 1 page said, I am the sister in charge of this boy. These directives are beyond reason, if not absurd. I demand to know the meaning of these instructions. I demand to know upon whose authority they are given. Yours in the service of the light, Sister Verna Soventrain. The 2nd page said, You will do as you are instructed or suffer the consequences. Do not presume to question the orders of the palace again. In my own hand, the prelate. The sister's face had drained of color.
You had no business reading something belonging to another?
As I said, you were dead at the time. What instructions did they give you about me that made you so angry? The color came back to her face in a rush.
It has to do with the technicality. It's nothing you would understand, and anyway, it's none of your business.
Richard lifted an eyebrow.
Not my business?
You claim you are only trying to help me, yet you've taken me prisoner. And you say it's not my business? I have this collar around my neck, and with it you can hurt me, perhaps kill me, and you say it is not my business? You tell me I must do the things you say, that I must take them on faith, even though that faith is shaken with every new thing I discover, yet it's not my business? You tell me that the illusion I saw was not as things are in the real world, yet I find it was, and you tell me it's not my business?
Sister Verna was silent. She watched him without emotion. Watched him, he thought, as if he were a bug in a box.
Sister Verna, will you tell me one thing I've been wondering about?
If I can.
He pulled his legs up tighter under himself. He tried to keep any hostility out of his tone. When you first saw me, you were surprised that I was grown. You thought that I would be young.
That's right. We have ones at the palace who can sense one born with the gift. But you were hidden from us, so it took us a very long time to find you.
But you told me just the other day that you had spent over half your life away from the palace searching for me. If you've spent 20-odd years looking for me, how could you expect me to be young? You would have expected me to be grown unless you didn't know I had been born and started searching for me long before anyone at the palace sensed me.
Her answer came in a cautious, quiet voice. It is as you say. It has never happened this way before.
So why would you come looking for me before any of you sensed that one with the gift had been born?
She chose her words carefully. We didn't know precisely when you would be born, but we knew you would be, so we were sent in search.
How did you know I would be born?
You are spoken of in prophecy.
Richard nodded. He wanted to know about this prophecy and why they thought he was so important, but he didn't want to stray from the trail he was following at the moment.
So you knew it might be many years before you found me?
Yes.
We didn't know when you would be born. We were only able to narrow it to a range of decades.
How are the sisters who are to be sent chosen?
We're selected by the prelate.
You have no say in the matter?
She tensed, as if suspicious she might accidentally be slipping her neck through a noose, yet was unable to keep from voicing her faith. We work in the service of the Creator. We would have no reason to object. The whole purpose of the palace is to help those with the gift. To be selected to save one with the gift is one of the greatest honors a sister may receive.
So, none of the others sent have ever had to give up so many years of their lives to rescue one with a gift?
No, I've never heard of it taking more than a year, but I knew this assignment could last for decades.
Richard smiled to himself in triumph. He leaned back, stretching his muscles. He took a deep breath. Now I understand. Her eyes narrowed.
What do you understand?
I understand, Sister Verna, why you treat me the way you do. I understand why we're always fighting, why we're always at each other's throats. I understand why you resent me, why you hate me.
She looked like someone waiting for the trap door to fall out from under her. I don't hate you, Richard.
He nodded and pulled the catch on that trap door. Yes, you do. You hate me. And I don't blame you. I understand. You had to give up Jedediah because of me.
She flinched, as if a noose had just tightened around her neck.
Richard, you will not speak to me in...
You resent me because of that, not because of what happened to the other two sisters.
It's because of Jedediah. If it weren't for me, you would be with him. You would have been with him for the last 20 years. You had to give up the love of your life to go on this accursed quest to find me. They sent you. You had no choice. You had to go. It's your duty, and it cost you your love and the children you might have had. That's what I've cost you. Why you hate me.
Sister Verna sat and stared. She neither spoke nor moved. Finally she said, "A seeker indeed."
"I'm sorry, Sister Verna."
"No need to be, Richard. You don't know what you're talking about."
She slowly lifted the rabbit from the fire, setting it on the iron plate with the bannock. For a moment, she stared off into nothing.
"We had better finish eating. We must be on our way."
"Fine. But I just want you to consider, sister, that it's not by my choice. I didn't do this to you, the prelate did. You should either be angry with her, or if you're so devoted to your duty to your Creator, as you claim, then you should have joy in his service. Either way, please stop blaming me. She opened her mouth to speak, but then instead fumbled with the stopper on the water skin, finally getting it off, and took a long drink. Drawing deep breaths when she finished, she dabbed her sleeve to her wet lips. Her unwavering gaze locked on his. Soon, Richard, we will be to the palace. But first we have to pass through the land of a very dangerous people. The sisters have an arrangement with them to be allowed to pass. You will have to do a task for them. You will do it, or there will be great trouble. What will I have to do? You will have to kill someone for them. Sister Verna, I promise you, I'm not going to... Her index finger rose from her fist, commanding silence. Don't you dare swing the axe this time, Richard, she whispered. You have no idea of the consequences. She rose to her feet. Get the horses ready. We must be leaving. Richard stood. Aren't you going to have your breakfast? She ignored his question and stepped close to him. It takes two to argue, Richard. You're always angry with me with everything I tell you. You resent me. You hate me because you think I made you put on that collar. But I didn't, and you know it. Kaelin made you put it on. It's because of her you wear the Radahan. If it weren't for her, you wouldn't be with me. That's what I've cost you and why you hate me. But I think you should consider, Richard, that it's not by my choice. I didn't do this to you. Kaelin did. You should either be angry with her, or if you're so devoted to her as you claim, then have joy in carrying out her wishes. Perhaps she has valid reasons for them. Maybe she has your interests at heart. Either way, please stop blaming me. Richard tried to swallow, but couldn't. Chapter 37. The blood-red light of day's death oozed through the bones of trees lining the spine of the next ridge. Her green-eyed gaze left the well-hidden places where outposts of sentries were stationed. They were too far apart, she noted, or she would not be standing unnoticed where she was. She tallied the men in rank upon rank of tents marching up the valley floor below. 5,000 would be generous, she concluded. Horses were picketed to her left, near supply wagons, all neatly lined up. To the far side of the valley, latrines had been dug in the snow. Cook wagons stationed between the men and the supply wagons were packing up for the night. Colorful battle flags flew over the command tents. It was probably the most orderly army she had ever seen afield. Galeans did have a penchant for order. They look very nice, Chandelin said in a quiet voice, for men about to be slaughtered. The two brothers gave nervous chuckles of agreement. Kaelin nodded absently. That morning, they had seen the army these men were chasing. They were not neat. They were not orderly. They were not pretty, and their sentries were not stationed too far apart. Still, Chandelin and the two brothers had managed to get her close enough to see what she had wanted to see and to take a tally. She had guessed their numbers at 50,000, and that was not being generous. She let out a long breath, its thin white cloud drifting away in the cold air. I have to stop this. She hiked her pack and bow up on her back. Let's get down there. Chandelin, Prendon, and Tossidan followed behind as she slogged down the hillside of fluffy snow. It had taken her longer than she had hoped to catch these men. A blizzard, high in Jara Pass, had left the four of them holed up in the shelter of a wayward pine for 2 days. Wayward pines always reminded Kaelin of Richard. And, as she had lain in her fur mantle, listening to the howl of the wind, she had dreamed of him while she slept, and while she was awake. She was furious that she had to lose valuable time on the way to Adendrill to stop this army from their suicide pursuit of the forces that had destroyed Ebenicia. But as the Mother Confessor, she couldn't allow nearly 5,000 men to die to no purpose. She had to stop them before they got close to the army that had plundered Ebenicia. They were too close now. They would surely make contact by the next day. The army sprang to alert as the four figures in white wolf-pelt mantles marched toward them. Shouts erupted and were repeated back through the ranks. Tent flaps were flung open and men poured out. Swords were drawn, sending the ring of steel into the cold twilight air. Men with spears came running through the snow. Men with bows took up positions, knocking arrows. A wall of several hundred men put themselves between her and the command tents. More were coming at a run, pulling on clothes, shouting to others still in their tents. Kaelin and the three men with her came to a halt. She stood tall and still. Behind her, Chandelin, Prindon, and Tossadin leaned lazily on their spears. A man of rank tumbled out of the largest tent as he pulled on a heavy brown coat. He made his way through the wall of men, shouting at the archers to hold their arrows. He was joined by two others of rank as he stumbled through the line of defenders. She recognized his rank as he approached. He was the captain. The two men with him, one to each side, were lieutenants. When he drew himself to a panting halt before her, she let the hood of her mantle drop back. Her long hair fell across the white fur.
"What is the—"
The captain's eyes went suddenly wide. He and the two lieutenants collapsed to a knee. Every man, as far as she could see, fell to his knees, every head bowed. The rustle of wool, the creak of leather, and the clang of steel fell silent. The three men with her cast one another glances of wonder. They had never seen the Mother Confessor greeted by anyone but mud people before. The only sound was the slow creak of branches in the cold breeze. "Rise, my children." Accompanied by the renewed racket of movement, all came to their feet. The captain stood and gave her a smart bow from the waist. He came up with a proud smile.
"Mother Confessor, what an honor!"
Kaelin stared in disbelief at his square jaw, his wavy light brown hair, his clear blue eyes, his young, handsome face.
"You're a child," she whispered.
She looked around to the hundreds, the thousands of young, bright eyes all fixed on her. She blinked at them. She could feel the blood going to her face. Her fists tightened as she shook with rage.
"You're children. You're all children."
The captain glanced back to his men with an embarrassed expression bordering on hurt.
"Mother Confessor, we're new recruits, but we're all soldiers of the Galleon army."
"You are all children," she whispered. "Children."
Silence swept over the gathered recruits. Most looked to be 15 or 16 years. The captain and his two lieutenants shifted their weight and hung their heads. Some of the men couldn't help staring openly at Chandelin, Prindon, and Tossadin. They had never seen anyone like them before. Kaelin grabbed the captain's lapels and began dragging him off. She growled to the two lieutenants,
"You two come along with us."
She glared over their heads. "Everyone go back to what you were doing." There was a rattle of swords being returned to scabbards and arrows to quivers as she dragged the captain out of earshot of his men. When she reached the tree, she pulled him toward a log and released him with an angry shove. Kaelin flopped down on a snow-covered log, as if it were a throne. She folded her arms. Chandelin stood to her right, Prindon and Tossadin to her left. They planted the butts of their spears and waited in silence. She gritted her teeth.
"What is your name, Captain?"
He fumbled with a brass button on his open coat. "I'm Bradley Ryan." His blue eyes came up.
"Captain Bradley Ryan, Mother Confessor."
He quickly glanced away to the man at his right.
"This is Lieutenant Nolan Sloan."
He pointed to the other side. "This is Lieutenant Flynn Hobson."
"How many children do you have along with you, Captain Ryan?"
He stiffened a little. "Mother Confessor, we may be younger than you, although not by much, and you may not think highly of us, but we're soldiers, good soldiers."
"Good soldiers."
She was hardly able to keep herself from screaming at him. "If you're such good soldiers, then why was I able to walk unnoticed through your line of sentries?" His face reddened, and he made a visible effort to remain silent. "And is there a one of these good soldiers, including you three, that is beyond 18? He pressed his lips tighter and shook his head.
"Then I repeat, how many children do you have along with you?"
"There are 4,500 under my command."
"And do you know, Captain Ryan, that you are about to stumble upon a force 10 times your size?"
Captain Ryan lifted an eyebrow, and a little boy grin grew out of the one side of his mouth.
"We are not about to stumble upon anyone, Mother Confessor. We're about to catch them. We've been chasing them. I think we'll have them tomorrow."
She gritted her teeth anew.
"Have them? Tomorrow? If I hadn't caught up with you, young man, you and all of your
men would die. You have no idea of the army you are about to catch. He lifted his chin. We know what we are chasing. We have scouts, you know. I get reports. Kaelin shot to her feet, thrusting her arm to the right and pointing. There are 50,000 men around that mountain. 52,000 and a few hundred. He shrugged. We're not stupid. We know what we're doing. Her arm dropped as she glared. Oh, you do, do you? And just what were you going to do once you caught them? Captain Ryan smiled as he leaned in, sure that he could prove to her that he indeed did know what he was doing. Well, they're about to come to a divergence in the pass. I'm going to send a force up there around them to come in from each fork. They'll think they're being attacked by a large force. We're going to drive them back this way, where we're going to be waiting for them, beyond the narrows just ahead. Then we're going to retreat back this way to the narrows, then split the flank, let them in until they have nowhere to go. The pikemen will be bunched in the narrowest place. They're called the anvil. Archers to the sides will hold the enemy to the center. The force driving them is called the hammer. His grin widened. We'll crush them in the middle. He flicked his hand in a casual manner as he straightened a little. It's a classic tactic. It's called the hammer and anvil. Dumbfounded, Kaelin stared at him. I know what it's called, young man. The hammer and anvil is a bold maneuver, under the right conditions. Against a force 10 times your size, it's beyond foolhardy. You are a badger trying to swallow an ox whole. We were taught that with good timing and determination, a small force of good men in a tight place, like this valley... Good men? You think that's going to count with the spirits? Is that what your pride and presumption leads you to think? The captain's eyes descended to the ground. You can't push a boulder with a stick. The only way to move them back this way is to frighten them into moving back. She thrust her arm out, pointing off toward the enemy again. Those are experienced, battle-hardened men. They've been fighting and killing for a good long time. Do you think they don't know what a hammer and anvil is? Do you think that just because they're the enemy, they are stupid? Well, no, but I think... She jabbed a finger at his chest as she cut him off. Do you want me to tell you what's going to happen, Captain? You don't have enough men to push them. When you send that detachment around them, they will accommodate you and move a little. And as they do, they'll wing out to let your force in. That's called a nutcracker. Guess who the nut is? Then they will move for your anvil. They will be hounds roused to the scent of blood. After they've wiped out your hammer, there will be nothing to contain them, nothing to keep their flanks from wheeling as they drive in. They have battle experience and know exactly what to do. They'll split your pikemen and their archers and cut them off from their supporting swordsmen. A flying wedge protected by shields will drive into those pikemen. Crescents to the sides will trap them. Their armored cavalry will come at a full charge and rake down your wings of archers, who will by then have no pikemen to blunt the charge.